How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
On today's episode, the first interview will be with Marion Adair, the chair of Biodiversity BC's steering committee.
What we're finding is that biodiversity in BC is actually still in relatively good shape, but we're right on the verge of things deteriorating fairly quickly unless we take some action to conserve those values.
And our second interview is with Deborah Harford, who is the program director of SFU's Adaptation on Climate Change team.
We actually initiated it in November 2006. And it's a five-year series of six-month-long sessions, each one looking at a top-of-mind climate change impact area and producing policy recommendations and resources for the public and public awareness raising around each issue.
I'm Kim Tay.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher.
Welcome to today's show. The two people that we're interviewing, Marion Adair and Deborah Harford, are both from programs aim to bring different people from different sectors together, government, academic experts, industry, the public, nonprofit organizations. Because I think what I have been hearing about lately is the importance of collaboration and cooperation in terms of helping us adapt to climate change, creating solutions to some of the problems that we're going to be experiencing in the near future. And that's been a common thread with many people who are talking about these issues, is that we cannot solve this individually. We must start collaborating with each other and start listening to each other. And that goes for every single different level of government and group.
As the Beatles said, come together right now.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that's what needs to be done. So first up is Marion Adair, and she's talking about biodiversity in British Columbia. Now, biodiversity in British Columbia, actually, according to a study that they have done, is doing much better than other areas of the world. The main reasons being because British Columbia has not been as developed as other certain areas of the world. And also we have quite a diversity of landscapes and ecosystems as well as species. So it has been able to maintain resiliency for a number of reasons. So that's promising. But as she mentions, it's on the verge of changing dramatically. And her group, Biodiversity BC, looks at ways to curb the impact of the future on biodiversity in British Columbia so that we can maintain our species and help keep our ecosystems resilient.
Oh, really good.
She talks a lot about why biodiversity is actually important, because I asked her, why should people care about biodiversity? A lot of people care about climate change because that's the catchphrase now, and that's the word that everybody knows. But in reality, there's so many other things kind of beneath that we depend on in our ecosystem,
yeah.
Biodiversity being one of them. So she talks about why it's actually important to care about different species.
I think that's going to be the next big thing. Is biodiversity. I think that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, I think that people are catching on. So here's Marion Adair. Today I am speaking with Marion Adair, who is the chair of Biodiversity BC's Steering Committee. Thanks so much for joining me today, Marion.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So we're talking about biodiversity in British Columbia. Could you explain to listeners who don't really know what biodiversity is, what is it?
Okay, well, to start off with, biodiversity in its sort of most simple terms is short for biological diversity. And so if we think of it a little bit beyond that, it's the variety of life in all its forms. So that can range from thinking about it at the genetic level to species to ecosystems, and then all of the processes that tend to interlink all of that. And in a lot of ways, what a lot of people would maybe just simply think of as nature.
So that doesn't necessarily mean that it's just organisms or mammals or animals. It also means, you know, ecosystems as a whole.
Ecosystems and things like the processes that link those. So you sort of, well, what are those processes? Well, those can be processes such as pollination can be considered as a process, or decomposition as a process. Concepts like connectivity, so the connection between different units or different ecosystems. So it's that whole web, that whole interconnectedness that we think of then as biodiversity. So it's more complex than maybe just thinking of single species or ecosystems. It's the complexity of all of them together. And we can think of ecosystems and biodiversities within a set space that could be as small as a small little pond, or as large as a unit, say, as the province, or in some sort of ecological definition, or even you can even get to the world, as if we think of it in that context.
How biologically diverse is British Columbia?
Well, in terms of looking at British Columbia's biological diversity, there was a report that was released this summer called Taking Nature's Pulse, the Status of Biodiversity in British Columbia. And this report was a result of an array of scientists, those with, I would say, the best sort of ecological thinking that we have right now in British Columbia, coming together and agreeing on what the status of biodiversity is within the province, what its significance is, and what are the threats facing it. So in terms of how are we doing, this result of these over 50 scientists, including international peer reviewers, came up with 23 major findings that they came to consensus on. And the overall, I guess, wrap-up statement is, and I quote from it, it says, British Columbia's biodiversity is globally significant because of its variety and integrity, but without immediate action is vulnerable to rapid deterioration, especially in light of climate change. So what we're finding is that biodiversity in BC is actually still in relatively good shape. And that is because of our extraordinary and largely intact nature of our ecosystems. And this is probably thanks to our province's unusual geologic history, the sort of wide climatic variations we have, and topography, and the brief time that we've had industrial development within this province. So we've got a unique situation from a global perspective in that our biodiversity is still fairly intact and in fairly good shape, but we're right on the verge of things deteriorating fairly quickly unless we take some action to conserve those values.
And I think one thing that's important to point out is that it can happen very, very quickly because we don't know what thresholds are being met in the ecosystem. And then all of a sudden you have species collapsing in many different ecosystems because they all depend on one another.
Yes, that is very true. And I think it's the stories that are often told and thought of when people think of all of the biodiversity, sort of the concept of keeping all the parts. And it's the concept of the old airplanes that had rivets, and you can keep losing different rivets here and there, and you don't really notice anything. But when is it going to be that one rivet that the actual wing drops off and you have some sort of catastrophic effect? And that's the same concept in terms of our ecosystems. And when they become stressed or altered to a state that they then convert into something completely different. And that is something that we're seeing right now being triggered potentially with climate change. It is having impacts on our systems that are forcing changes that, and it's the rapidity of the changes. Everything's always been fluid, has always been evolving through time. But right now what's different is it's the rate of change that is most significant. And you're right, we could end up with things definitely collapsing. You know, we've seen worldwide things like on the fisheries stocks and so on.
Mm-hmm. Why should people care about biodiversity? Because I've heard it said in a couple of different instances by various people that I'm living in the city, that polar bear that is potentially becoming extinct isn't my polar bear, it's not in my backyard. Therefore, you know, it's hard for me to actually care about that. Why should people care about the preservation of bugs and invertebrates and fungi and plants and all of that? Why should people care?
Well, and I think that's something that's a really important question, and I think that's something that people really need to become more aware about. What is biodiversity, and what does it mean to me? And what does it mean to me living right here in British Columbia? And I think one can take a look at it in terms of, with a healthy environment, healthy ecosystems around us, this is the underpinning of our economy. So we start to think of biodiversity as providing ecological goods and services. There are ecosystem outputs and benefits, and if we think of them in terms of how that supports us as human beings, there are, you know, wood and fibers that support our forest industry. We're looking at food that we eat, so in our agricultural industry, we're looking at clean drinking water, clean air, functioning, well-functioning ecosystems. They provide those services for us. And the other kind of concepts are things like climate regulation. If we can also look at a well-functioning ecosystems as actually having a mitigating effect to some of the impacts of climate change. The classic examples that are given out are things like well-functioning wetlands in providing water purification. The concept of pollination, for example, I'm not sure how many people realize that one in every three bites of food that they eat is a result of animal plant pollination. If we didn't have those pollinators, and people have heard the stories about the bees, just think what a significant impact that would have. And these we all just take for granted. And we talk about all of the little microorganisms. You were mentioning the invertebrates and so on. Those all have an incredible role to play in terms of our soil development. They're the ones who take all of the waste products, decompose, bring the nutrients back into the system and so on. And I think that is something we need to get a greater understanding about and understand that having a healthy ecosystem, having a healthy biodiversity is essential for sustaining both the environmental and us as human beings, our own well-being. And I think that we're starting to sort of also look at sort of the more intangible aspects as well. So having these well-functioning ecosystems, it's those natural landscapes then that also attracts us as British Columbians and those that are in, you know, major urban centers like Metro Vancouver that and tourists from around the world. We market this biodiversity in essence within British Columbia, and this is what provides our recreational enjoyment and spiritual renewal. So I think all of that, it's a whole array of the benefits from the goods and services through to our livelihood, the well-being that we have become accustomed here within British Columbia. And I think we're starting to see, although right now the economic climate maybe is challenging this, but we're starting to see a shift from viewing the environment or maintaining our biodiversity as an intangible or an external value in economic decisions to starting to incorporate those values as an essential value, so what some people are starting to think of as the triple bottom line. And I think another way to think about it for people, if they would say, you know, why should I care? I think that we're starting to see different polling information as well, that people are kind of gaining a better appreciation of what biodiversity's role is and about ecological goods and services. And it also then serves our ecosystem resilience and also then our economic resilience. So we can think of it maybe as our, in quote, natural insurance policy when we're in this kind of rapidly changing world. I think if maybe we can start connecting a little bit there, people would have an appreciation of why they should maybe take into consideration how they value those biodiversity considerations in what they do in terms of how they use and relate to the natural world.
So how do you encourage people to do that?
Well, I guess, first of all, it's getting an understanding of what those values are. So this document, Taking Nature's Pulse, it's the first time that we've actually compiled that information in one place. And mind you, it's a science-based document, but taking that information there and translating that out into maybe tangible examples through education, whether that's education through universities or even the school system and so on, and direct experience of people within the natural world to gain more of an appreciation of what we have in terms of biodiversity, I think we need to get that message out. And we have a good starting place right now with Taking Nature's Pulse. We need to start getting that word out. I think it's like anything else. Climate change was a concept for a long time that people sort of thought about it way out there somewhere. But now they're understanding it, maybe more so with the kind of consensus of the international science community, but even more so than when they started to realize the impacts right directly in their backyards. And I think a lot of people became to realize when the, you know, the windstorms in Stanley Park, for instance, the sort of more unusual climate conditions that were happening. For those in the interior of our province, the impact of the mountain pine beetle, there we're seeing how inextricably linked climate change and biodiversity is. I think people, it's just under their consciousness. It's there. It's now making the connection.
Which is hard for some people to do because when we're living in a city and we're surrounded by concrete, we don't necessarily see those important fundamental connections on a daily basis.
That's true. And that's maybe where we need to find even maybe things like our sort of local green spaces that can maybe provide at least some experience there. There's some work that's been done by a fellow called Richard Louv, who has done quite a bit of work, and he's written a book called Nature's Deficit Disorder, The Last Child in the Woods. And here it's sort of looking at now our generations of younger people who don't have that connect to the natural environment. And if they don't experience that in their younger lives, that they don't have a connection as they get older. And that's growing up in these highly urbanized centers and not seeing how the connection to the natural world. And there's sort of a whole movement to try and have a reconnect for young people in terms of that. So that's something where in this concrete jungle, as you say, we can maybe try and start to take a look at that. I would wonder and challenge, too, how we sort of look at our urban landscape to try and incorporate more of the natural world within that. I think we're living in a place in Metro Vancouver that maybe is fortunate that we at least have the backdrop around us that has that right there. People appreciate the landscape of the North Shore Mountains. You know, the Fraser River, if they really go down and take a look, I mean, the Fraser River hosting some of the largest salmon runs in North America, of what we've got in terms of Boundary Bay, in terms of the estuary being the major stopover on the Pacific Flyway for birds migrating from Central and America and the South up through to the Arctic. And I think that shows that we need to ensure that some of those places are maintained. And maybe it's people getting out from their houses to really looking at the Lower Mainland. All you have to do is open a phone book and you take a look at the map, you know, of the Lower Mainland. And many people think of Vancouver as sort of the downtown core, you know, out in the West End. But really, that's just one end of the Metro Vancouver area. And you look at this map and you see this river and this estuary that creates out where we've got islands and a delta and the richness of what estuaries can convey. And I think we do have an opportunity here within the Metro Vancouver area to connect people to the landscape. I mean, I think of it in some senses in a way like we change our attitudes about things like drinking and driving. You know, it wasn't that many years ago that you wouldn't hesitate about drinking and driving, and now you very much do. It's the same with wearing a seatbelt. And in a way, I think that to some extent, we need to get a more informed understanding that everybody sort of has more of that conservation ethic.
Where do we start then in British Columbia to start to preserve what we have and make sure that the biodiversity in British Columbia doesn't get depleted?
Well, I think a good start has been Taking Nature's Pulse. And if you look at the major findings, so there were 23 major findings, and it's quite comprehensive. It looks at sort of all the aspects of biodiversity. So it's looking at species and ecosystems and the genetic level, and then it talks about the key and special elements, and then it talks about the array of threats. And so when you roll that up and come up with sort of, so what is that? What is all of that telling us? What a large part we're looking at is that there are four broad ecosystem areas within the province that are of conservation concern. And those broad areas are what they call coastal Douglas fir zone. And so that's an area that encompasses the Gulf Islands, the southern part of Vancouver, and a little bit on the lower mainland here. It also includes what they call the bunch grass and the ponderosa pine and the interior Douglas fir zones. And these are those dry grassland and dry forested ecosystems within the interior of the province, in around Kamloops, the Okanagan Valley, a little bit up into the Chilcotin, and in the east Kootenay Trench. And here is where you also have an aggregation of the highest numbers of species at risk, the highest richness of numbers of species, and you also have the higher number of smaller plant communities of risk. And those four broader areas of concern are also lower elevation, and they also happen to also be the areas that we as human beings find the most desirable to live, work, and play. They are the areas with those rich valley bottoms. They're the areas that tend to either be estuaries, say, out in the greater Vancouver area. You've got the richer soils and that richer diversity. So here is where the highest threats are. The threats in terms of converting those rare ecosystems into something else than what they were, or degrading them somehow. And then also those threats of alien species. So what can we do about that? First of all, it's understanding where our sort of richness in the biodiversity is and where the major threats are, and can we do something about it? And so climate change, as I think we all may probably realize, is the major overriding and long-term threat to biodiversity in this province. But also, if we're looking at sort of the ecosystem conversion changes and alien species, then we can probably all start to take action there. One big thing on this is it's not any one person, it's not any one government, it's not any one group that's going to be able to solve this. It's going to need everybody. And so it's going to be everybody, and if we're talking about individuals of what they can do, they can start by, first of all, getting informed about what is it, what is important about biodiversity, why is there a threat, why is there something happening here that I should be concerned about. We need to sort of look at promoting more scientific research in these areas because we don't have enough information. If we're talking about individuals, reducing your ecological footprint, you know, becoming a greener consumer, and maybe demanding more political leadership. Politicians tend to respond to where the demands are within the population. Get involved in local stewardship projects. And here's a great way, if people would like to see where, just in their own backyard, that they can start taking some actual action. And that may be looking at moving invasive weed species and then getting plugged into different community groups and so on. And I'm sure there's numbers of web blogs, et cetera. And then just getting out and enjoying nature. Get out there and get a better appreciation of what this province has. And I know those may be just broader concepts, but I think those are where it starts.
Thanks for that. Those are some good places to start from. I think they're practical for people to do.
Yeah.
Because it is quite a complex issue. And when you start looking into the scientific details of it, even though we need more science, I think for a lot of people it's hard to actually understand it because it is so complex. So to break it down into practical things that people can do makes sense.
Yes, and I think that's, you know, really worthwhile. And once you start getting into it, you start getting the appreciation and the understanding. Then it's a matter of you as an individual, but then you start thinking of you as somebody in the workplace, and what kinds of things would you do if you're in a certain industry? How can you think about conserving biodiversity as part of forestry operation or as part of an agricultural operation and so on? It doesn't mean that you go and stop everything in terms of the province or the economics. It's not that at all, nor is it about necessarily putting everything in some protected areas. It's about how we actually use and relate to our natural systems, considering biodiversity values within that. And I think starting as ourselves, as just as individuals, but then moving into where we are in industry, and then even broader than that, if you're working with, say, governments, how do plans, how do things like official community plans, which are sort of the template, the base of which local government, whether that's cities, towns, villages, or regional governments, use to guide their decisions on development, where it would go, how it would go, and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where everybody starts to work towards these ends. And hopefully we start seeing some responses to the resilience and of our ecosystems. You know, for instance, in valley bottom areas with local governments, if they have the broader context of understanding where the biodiversity values are, are there any blocks or any barriers to the connectivity, for instance, of enabling, say, species to move through? The classic example that's quite often given is Kelowna spreading out in the middle of the Okanagan Valley, and understanding that there's a conduit up from the Great Basin Desert in the U.S. up through the Okanagan, and that those species with climate change moving to move more northward up into the Chilcotin need to get past Kelowna. And where there is ability to build those connectivity corridors there into their planning is an example where local government can start working together. And it would be mutually beneficial. They need their green spaces. They need to look to where they can factor those in. But if they can do it so that it's a win for biodiversity as well, it's a win for all of us.
Where does your organization, Biodiversity BC, fit into all of this? Like, I should have asked you that at the beginning.
Well, so I'm like, yeah, I'd probably go, who the heck is Biodiversity BC?
So I guess maybe could you, because I know you were talking about collaboration, bringing everybody together, and that's what I think is great about Biodiversity BC, is that it is bringing government and industry together. So could you explain who is involved in your organization, and beyond the publication Taking Nature's Pulse, what else are you doing?
Okay, well, Biodiversity BC, and as you say, collaboration consensus is a really strong theme that that I think is really important in all of this. And Biodiversity BC was established in 2005, and it is a partnership between seven non-government organizations and three levels of government, including Union of BC Municipalities representing local government, the provincial government, and the federal government. And we also have First Nations consultant working with us on our steering committee. So it was established in 2005 to develop a biodiversity strategy for the province. And we were funded for a five-year period, so our mandate currently expires at the end of 2009. We were funded with $1.8 million through the BC Trust for Public Lands. When we looked at developing a biodiversity strategy, we looked at this in three phases. The first phase was to develop the science foundation. So before we could determine what we needed to do or where we need to go, we needed to understand where we are now. And so what we have now, and what I've been speaking about, Taking Nature's Pulse, the status of biodiversity in British Columbia, is the culmination of that science foundation. And in case any of the listeners are interested, this document and an array of other documents are available on Biodiversity BC's website, which is www.biodiversitybc.org. We've now got to this point. The next steps is looking at defining priorities for action. And then obviously, as any other planning process out into the future, would look at sort of the actions being taken and then, ongoing determining how well we're doing. So Biodiversity BC, in the process then of developing the Science Foundation, developed a vision that would guide that. And our vision statement is British Columbia is a spectacular place with healthy, natural, and diverse ecosystems that sustain and enrich us all. And there were three goals then that came out of that. The first goal is conserving the elements of biodiversity. So this is, you know, maintaining that genetic diversity, the species, the East Coast systems, and preventing those elements from becoming either at risk and contributing to global efforts for biodiversity conservation. The second goal, and I think we've kind of talked about this actually in this interview more so, but it's increasing the awareness and of the importance of biodiversity and respect for the natural environment. And the third goal is an enabling goal. It's providing the tools and incentives to enable biodiversity conservation. So that's Biodiversity BC, which is this collaborative partnership between non-government and government organizations, is developed this to this date, where Biodiversity BC itself is focusing at this point on the goal two, which is increasing the awareness and looking at the tools. The provincial government has decided or has picked up, I guess, the baton to some extent in taking a leadership role in conserving the elements of biodiversity, and they've got an initiative called their Conservation Framework, which is looking at how to prioritize the conservation efforts for the species and the ecosystems. And we're working with the province as they're developing this prioritization tool. That's where the action is starting to happen. And Biodiversity BC is right now in coming into our final year of our mandate, looking to move to get the awareness out and looking to where we go beyond 2009 in terms of maintaining what has been such a success to date, which is that independent science based information that supports the actions that would come out of this.
My last question is, if there's one message that you have for listeners to take away from our interview today, what would that be?
To really enjoy nature, find out, get in touch with British Columbia has to offer. We've got so much of it, and we're so fortunate living in both this province, but also within Metro Vancouver. It is very close at hand. And understanding what we've got there, then start thinking about your own lives and how you relate to that environment. And remember, how you relate to that environment may also have an implication to jobs and things in the future, because it really does, it's inextricably linked to the economy.
Thank you so, so much, Marianne. I really appreciate hearing your perspective today and hearing about Biodiversity BC and the activities that are going on in the province with regards to biodiversity preservation.
Great. And as I say, I encourage people to go to the website. And if they have any further questions, there's also a link to our virtual secretariat so that people can get back to people if they have any comments or concerns or whatever.
Great. Thanks so much, Marianne. That was Marianne Adair of Biodiversity BC.
And now we're going to have Deborah Hartford of the Adaptation on Climate Change team. She is the program director.
And the Adaptation on Climate Change team is actually an SFU program, and it aims to bring people from industry, the public, government, academics, pretty much just it aims to bring everybody together to talk about some of the problems that we are experiencing with regards to climate change, and then also to come up to solutions on how we can adapt to it. So here is Deborah Harford. Hi there, Deborah. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi,
I'm
Deborah.
Here.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Definitely. Now, I had just actually heard about this adaptation on climate change team a short while ago. It's fairly new. Can you start off by describing what exactly it is and what goals you aim to achieve with the program?
Absolutely, yes. We actually initiated it in November 2006, and it's a five-year series of six-month-long sessions, each one looking at a top-of-mind climate change impact area and producing public policy recommendations and resources for the public and public awareness raising around each issue. So the issues are things like sea level rise, fresh water supply, health risks, extreme weather impacts, biodiversity, and within the biodiversity piece there's ecosystem range shifts and species range shifts and how those will affect resource-dependent communities. So we'll also be looking at crop and food adaptation. So we've identified what look as though they are the top nine climate impact areas that we will all feel and in many cases are already feeling both here and around the world. and that need that we're trying to help government and the public and industry and communities develop resources to deal with the impact.
What does this program aim to do that hasn't been done before with regards to climate change policy?
You'll find that there's a lot of fantastic research being done on adaptation when you scratch the surface in Canada. But there has not been a high-level focus on how to adapt. And tools are being developed by people such as the University of Washington's Climate Impacts Group. And if you look at the UK, the UK Climate Impacts Program, which is a nationally funded body. But here in Canada, we really need to move ahead on planning for how to deal with the wide suite of issues. Adaptation to things like pine beetle epidemic is being addressed now. Interestingly, within the provincial government, they've moved that from forestry to community development. So that's a clear indication of working on adaptation at that level. But we kind of want to bring this stuff to the public's attention because a lot of people don't realize just how much is going on and what the threats are. And to develop new and dynamic recommendations for how to deal with those things.
Okay, so who exactly is involved in this program?
Well, it's a nimble team, if you like. We've got steering faculty from our main steering faculty is Dr. Nancy Olawiler, who's the director of the Master of Public Policy program. And we also have Mark Winston, who is the academic director of the WASC Center for Dialogue, and Anthony Pearl, who's the director of the Urban Studies Program. Those are the three faculty who were involved with me when we started this up. The team aspect comes from each different session. Sometimes there are people who are experts that run through all of these nine sessions. But a lot of the time, there are specific experts for each one, obviously. So when we are saying team, we're basically trying to bring in the best minds, the best and brightest minds on these issues, not just from Canada and BC, but from elsewhere in the world, if that's where they're located, to collaborate with us and to work on it.
One thing that I find really cool about this program is that there is a lot of collaboration and there's a lot of discussion between different industries and different groups or different interest groups.
Yeah, definitely.
Is that one of the key things that we need to have in order to adapt to climate change? Is that, you know, dialogue and talking to one another and helping each other figure these things out?
Definitely, yeah, and that's why we're trying to leverage SFU's considerable expertise in communications and dialogue, because we're trying to bring together the theoretical through the span of all of the knowledge to the practical. So we bring together, within each session, we put on conferences, and at the conferences, we bring together experts from academia, all three levels of government. We bring together First Nations, NGOs, students, and community representatives to try and not only look at the big picture and raise awareness about what's happening and what the big threats are that we face and the impacts people are already feeling, but to identify what the practical measures would be, because quite often you get really good research which says there's going to be, you know, much more severe rainfall as severe storms increase. But a city planner who's working on the infrastructure of, say, a sewer system needs to know, well, how much more rainfall will there be in the first 30 minutes of a rainstorm? So sometimes the data being produced by our fantastic experts doesn't quite match up with what's needed to make that planning practical. So we're trying to kind of close that loop.
So thinking back over the last 2 years since the Adaptation on Climate Change team was actually founded, What kind of policies have come out of that? If you think back to some of the topics that have been covered in the past before, what have been some of the positive outcomes of those discussions?
Yeah, well, we started in November 2006, that was the initial round of fundraising because we're generating this project as we go along. And so we got started in September of 2007, and our first session was on biodiversity and ran till April 2008. And I've just come from a meeting at which we are finalizing our first set of policy recommendations, which has come out of that first session. And it's taking a while because we want to be really sure sure that we're acknowledging the great work that our provincial government's already doing, and a lot of cutting-edge information is being produced day by day on biodiversity and species and ecosystems management and range shift. So we're trying to make sure it's as current and as relevant as possible. So those findings, that first set of recommendations, will be released on November the 12th. So that's a very exciting milestone for us. We're now currently in the middle of the extreme weather session, which runs from May till December of this year. And there's a public dialogue, actually, as part of that on climate impacts to infrastructure at SFU Surrey on October 16th from 3 till 5 p.m., which I really hope SFU students will come out to. And I can talk to a bit more about who's going to be speaking at that in a minute. But the recommendations from on extreme weather and how to adapt our infrastructure and plan for public safety and municipal adaptation will come out in early 2009.
Hopefully something will come out of all of these policies when you present it. Are you just presenting it to the government then?
Well, I'll just quickly add to that, but I think another positive outcome, I know another positive outcome that's already come out of what we're doing is that we've put on two conferences now that brought together people from, the first one was on biodiversity, brought people together from all over the province, from all the different sectors that I mentioned earlier. Then we had we're having three conferences in the extreme events session, and the first one was on adaptation for municipalities. We had people from all across Canada at that one. The 16th and 17th is climate impact to infrastructure. Again, people from all across Canada. And then on November 20th and 21st, the 20th is a very exciting day because we have speakers coming to speak from India, Africa, Australia, South America, and the Arctic about climate impacts and responses in their countries. And we'll then be rolling that into a dialogue about future for BC and how their expertise can help us inform the issues that we face here. So there's that's another, for me, one of the really exciting positive outcomes of what we're doing. In terms of where we'll take the recommendations, we will be briefing policymakers. We'd also like to, we're also going to be briefing leaders from the private sector because obviously decisions that are made in both of those areas are really key to how we move ahead in this situation.
In terms of where they'll take it from here, how are you hoping that they'll react to it?
Positively,
yeah.
with implement them with great gusto. It would be ideal if we can help raise awareness about the issues and plant some seeds in terms of how planning goes ahead. Obviously, we're in a period right now of lots of elections that will be changing the climate, if you'll pardon the pun, in the U.S. and in Canada federally and next year in our province and municipally. So we've got as many elections as you can possibly have in a six-month period going on. So I think that's a good time to bring up policy recommendations because it can go into planning for new administrations. And we definitely hope that at least some of the recommendations we put out will be implemented by decision makers.
In terms of the public getting involved in this, when they come to one of the conferences, one of the public dialogues, what should they come with? Any kind of information or questions?
Questions and stories and hopes and dreams. I mean, one of the great things about dialogue is you get to talk. Well, what we're trying to do with the public dialogues that we're putting on, my vision for them, is that we bring people that you wouldn't get to meet on a everyday basis. You can come and you can, hear what they have to say and hear this cutting-edge information that they've got, but you can ask them questions and share with them what you hope to see, studies that you'd like to see done. That it's really an opportunity for students who are leaders of tomorrow to come and share their vision of what should happen next, given the expertise these people share.
So that's really cool that somebody can, have that level of participation within, to actually say, I want to know, what impact climate change will have on this particular area because this is going to affect me. That's really cool that they're actually able to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And to be able to say, well, where else can I get this information? Who else can I talk to? Our dialogues allow people to also share, though, what they hope, what they're worried about on a personal level.
because I think, you know, it sometimes gets sort of lost in the high-level picture. It's all very theoretical. Well, we're trying to bring it down to the practical. How does this work for people at home? What can you do? How will it affect you? And hopefully it will stimulate. Students are some of the most proactive people. Hopefully for me, I hope also that it will stimulate people to go out and maybe even start initiatives of their own, maybe come and, you know, maybe volunteer with ACT on stuff, but to get involved also in what else is going on these important issues.
How do you feel that people are reacting to the idea of actually having to adapt to climate change?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at different countries, you get different levels of awareness. But everywhere there's a high level of awareness, people are starting to want to work on it. And if you take an example of the UK flooding last year, they've experienced, I don't know how many million pounds worth of damage in the UK floods. In Peterborough, Ontario, in between 2002 and 2005, Peterborough was hit by storms of a magnitude seen on average once every 100 years, costing homeowners and the province hundreds of millions of dollars. So any area that you get these kinds of impacts that people are really feeling, they are very excited about working on ways to protect their homes and their businesses. So the fact is we do live in the best place on earth. The impacts that are happening here, like the Stanley Park major storm in 2006 that also led to boil water advisory for 2 million British Columbians, was a fairly isolated incident, but it is a good example of what's going to be happening more and more. Sea level rise. Richmond is busy at work on how to deal with you know, the impact to homes and the coast there. They've got a $13 million coastal reinforcement plan that they're busy working on. So I think it's tough because people say, well, look, it's going to cost money and we don't know when it's going to happen. The trouble is that it is going to happen, and if we don't prepare for it, it's a bit like the current financial crisis in the global markets. You can't see exactly when it's going to happen, but when it does happen, it may happen really, really fast and cause an awful lot of damage. So it's better to be proactive. You know, I see that humans have an advantage as a species in that we can actually predict what's going to happen. So you know, it makes sense to plan now in a practical way that works for everybody rather than try and rescue ourselves from very costly crises when they hit later on.
Why do you think, I mean, I feel right now that there is a lot of momentum and a lot of energy moving towards, you know, making all of these changes. But why perhaps are we not moving there faster? Or do you feel like we're not moving there fast enough?
Well, as I say, if you look at places which have been really impacted, they're moving really fast.
Right.
In the UK, the National Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs funded the UK Climate Impacts Programme. So, and that, you know, they're working with county councils, and there's a lot going on there. I think to some degree, it's leadership from the top. We really need some top-down encouragement for this issue. We don't have much of it yet. I think the more that we have, the more that people will feel, oh yes, this is an endorsed issue, because I think sometimes people are sort of waiting to be told that it's important until they've been impacted, as I say. And then in that case, you start to get really strong grassroots movements moving upwards. And, you know, if you look at communities in BC's interior that are being affected by pine beetle, they're working really hard already on how to adapt to the changing resource environment. So, you know, I'm just advocating don't let's wait for crisis to push us into action. Let's plan for it now. But I think that the other reason is that there are so many pressures on people. You know, people are trying to reduce their emissions, so they're already adapting to that in that kind of way, to climate change pressure. But they've also got to pay their mortgages. They're worried about their investments, you know, or it's a terrorist attack, or it's, you know, there are lots of competing priorities for us. We're all very busy and a bit tired, I think, of trying to figure out which issue is the most important one. So I think it's best to make it practical, and I hope that we get some more top-down leadership on it soon to encourage some action on it.
How do you try to address the complexity of the climate change issue within the program? Because it is quite complex, and there's like lots of different information and studies coming from all different areas. How do you address that complexity?
Well, that's why we've organized the sessions into health, water, energy, sea level rise, crop adaptation. When you start to break those issues down, if you take water, for instance, it's completely related to energy, health and crop adaptation. But you've got to make it manageable, because if you try and deal with it all at once, it's so big and so complex that it's too daunting. So that's one way that we've tried to approach that. We've kind of made, you know, we've broken it down into issues, and as we go along, we'll be acknowledging the linkages between those issues. But I think the other part of that's important about your question is that when you think about adaptation, you have to start to adopt an adaptive mentality. In other words, we're kind of used to making rules based on a static system. You know, this is how it's always going to be. This rule is this rule is this rule. I think an adaptive mentality starts to accept, well, look, things are really changing a lot. And so we're going to need to revisit the decisions we made this year, next year. And we're going to have to take into account new information, and we're going to have to be a bit more nimble and maybe redesign some of our decision-making structures to deal with that complexity and the fact that all this information is changing just as the climate is changing.
Yeah, and all very, very quickly as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where can people go if they want to find more information?
They can go to our website, www.sfu.ca/act, and check out the details about the exciting event on November 20th, which is free to the public and to students at the WASC Center for Dialogue, and all the other details about our program and ways to contact us if you're interested in volunteering, and press releases and articles that have been published about us and by us.
That's cool. How can people get involved by volunteering? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, we've had some great people come and volunteer to work with us, and we've got people volunteering for everything from you know, helping us do mail outs, because we're sending lots of information out to potential conference participants and that kind of thing, to helping us with actual running conferences and volunteering in lots of different ways.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah, for sharing everything about the Adaptation to Climate Change team and what's to come in the future. I'm really looking forward to hearing some of those recommendations and attending some of the sessions myself, hopefully.
Yeah, definitely. We'll send you an invitation.
That's fantastic.
Keep you posted.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Deborah. Have an awesome day.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that's another episode of Sustainable Futures. It's been a really great audio journey with two excellent interviews that Kimberly has done for us this week.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, what I really like about these groups is that they are collaborative. They do aim to bring people from different places and experiences together. I think that that's a really important thing to do. And what's really interesting as well is I was talking to the spoken word coordinator here at CJSF, and she was talking about a woman who did a lot of writing about evolution of our society and how we are in a very competitive society right now in which we compete with each other. And our evolution will be to become more cooperative with each other, which I think is incredible. When you hear about it, it's very, very true.
Yeah, I think that is very true. There is a social evolution going on where there is a sort of a collective consciousness of sorts that's going to a new level, and we're starting to see the world in a different kind of way.
I think it's the way that we need to mature as a society. I think that here in North America in particular, we live in a very immature society. I mean, Europe is moving into a more mature society, and I think that we need to catch up. We need to grow up.
Grow up out there. No, just
well, it's true. We really do need to grow up and start taking responsibility for our actions, start taking back or start empowering ourselves and being conscious of the way that we live. And if you think about it, that's a very young, immature way to be living. So
it's a 2-year-old, right? Mine.
Yeah, or a teenage boy, but, you know. Yeah.
Well, cool. I like that this is happening.
Yeah, it's a good thing. And I look forward to seeing what will come of this collaborative effort by these two groups in the near future.
Yeah, and the future is exciting. I'd like to see what's going to develop as people come together more and more. You'll have some pretty exciting rallies and public interactions, and I think the future is exciting.
Well, actually, I have a really great quote that ties into that. I love this quote. A coworker of mine just sent it to me. It says, "The real trouble with this world of ours is not that it is an unreasonable world, or even that it is a reasonable one. The commonest kind of trouble is that it is nearly reasonable, but not quite. Life is not an illogicality, yet it is a trap for logicians. It looks just a little more mathematical and regular than it is. Its exactitude is obvious, but its inexactitude is hidden. Its wildness lies in wait. Isn't that great?
It's confusing.
It totally is, and it is a quote that I think you need to ponder on a little bit. So if you want a copy of the quote, you can email us at iamsustainable@gmail.com and I'll send it to you. But it's such a great quote because it just makes you go, okay. I actually had to think about that one. I had to sort of piece it apart and think about it bit by bit, but I love it. It's wildness lies in wait. I hope you enjoyed today's show.
I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And we are wishing you
a wild and sustainable future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.